Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Masonic Home Companion. I'm your host, Dale Graham. Great to have you back. Been another courageous week for Masons around the world, hasn't it? This is, of course, May 5th, 2013, or 6013 Anno Lucas, for those who appreciate the finer things of life. 125th day of the year, just to keep you in some perspective. I do hope that you'll be taking as much advantage of the events and festivities leading up to the solstice as you possibly can. We've just passed May Day here in this part of the world, and I think the rest of the world. It's related, as a matter of fact, May Day is related to the Celtic festival of Beltane, and there was a Germanic festival, Walpurgis Night, and it happens to fall half a year from May 1st, and that was another quarter century day, and that's associated with European paganism. You know, it's like you pull at one thread, and then it just keeps going on. That quarter year thing relates to the wheel of the year. It's an annual cycle of seasonal festivals in contemporary paganism. And there's eight festivals, and of course, they're around the solstice and equinox, and those are known as quarter days. And they have midpoints in between those events, which are known as cross quarter days. But within paganism, many festivals were celebrated. The way the term pagan is used in our time has really gone through, is quite a distortion, and I'm afraid it has to do with religion. It wasn't always that way. It didn't come into use until I think about the 4th century, 5th century. Now correct me if I'm wrong out there, and I know you will. But originally, it just meant a country dweller or a rustic or a civilian or a non-combatant. So I guess I'm guilty of all those in a way. So pagans, I guess, was just a pejorative term. Or it wasn't necessarily a pejorative term. And it just means indigenous or non-theistic religions. And of course, you know, when they were clamoring to establish a credibility in a time or a period when there's a lot of competition, branding would be important, and we would want to establish, appeal to a person's sense of provenance, age, older being better. As I get a little older, it strikes me as a bit of a funny thing to think of. I don't really care whether I don't truly care anymore about the age. It's what impact, what's it done, whether it's a painting, whether it's a car, you know, 56, whatever. Some of them were barges and some of them were just molded pieces of sculpture. Duesenberg, you know, sold in its day for what? The equivalent of hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars. So there are bits and pieces of ingenuity that today, I don't know if provenance, if being the oldest simply means me first. I was there first, or when somebody comes up with a novel or interesting idea, I think we've all outgrown the point where we hear somebody in the background saying, yeah, but I thought of it first. A bit boyishly competitive, unless, of course, you try and legitimize it by saying, well, we can patent that and make money, and then it becomes a matter of what? Whatever you call that. I'm not quite sure what that is anymore. But I see a lot of... I only tend to see the things as they are. With some of that is beneficial. You know, people making a profit so they can live. And, in broader terms, it's making a profit on the labors of other people, which fits into the definition of exploitive. Mm-hmm. Do you know that there are fewer than 100 fluent Latin speakers in the world? Now, that's a part of your... I want you to work that into your conversation today, not necessarily over coffee, and maybe when you're going through the experience of a bit of a single malt, that would be wonderful. Did you know that it's illegal to throw anything other than snow off a roof in the United Kingdom? Anything. So no bricks, no statuary, no anything. We are living in an age where we thought that, the feminist movement became quite pronounced and started to define inequities and roles in our contemporary society, and still we see people clinging to ideas that do not serve us well culturally or even in terms of the traditions. This notion that we can think that there's a subjugation of 51% of the world is really a progressive, more inaccurate way of thinking about gender. It doesn't really hold up to the math. Although bigger, you can dominate him. Gee, don't we call that bullying? Not exactly something I'd be proud of saying. The only place in the world where 50% of the MPs are female? You're not going to believe this one. Rwanda. A stain on the conscience of the world, if ever there was a country that had that ignominious claim. But time passes. Did you know we've discovered not too long ago, Reuters reported this on the 21st of March in 2013, about the universe, 13.8 billion years old. That's 100 million years older than we previously thought. I can't help thinking, when you're out there at 13.8 billion years, I guess 100 million years is big. Here, I think it's easy to lose track of time and the meaning of time. Here, where I'm sitting, 10,000 years ago, there's an ice sheet sitting over us, and people had to migrate south in front of that ice sheet. That's a phenomenal thing. I guess here I am thinking arrogantly, only 10,000 years ago. I've only been on this planet for 63 years. And it takes a certain arrogance to think that I'm living a long time. That's, I think, a very, very subjective and narrow sense of the world. I'm quite a superficial mark in the history of the world. As much as I want to think otherwise, there are a lot of other things to be remembered, and a lot of other things exist. We still haven't even come close to living as long as the dinosaurs. Should we live looking over our shoulder or pointing fingers? No, get over it. We need to experience everything that's going on within our species. And we see our conflicts, but we have this new phenomena. We have this, perhaps we're now challenging whether we are the only species that has consciousness. And that leads us to wonder why we seem to be focusing on such conflict. I'm not exactly sure that that's accurate. I know we make a lot, we point a lot of fingers at wars and battles and those types of things. But honestly, when the news comes on and it's about a car wreck, well, it's not exactly news. I feel sorry for people involved, truly. But I get what a car wreck is. It's an accident. And when people do something stupid, you know, and or they're, you know, they live a life where they have to run around with somebody supervising them, well, we train and hire police to do that for us, to keep an eye on people trying to take advantage of the rest of us, the people living an honest life. And it is what it is. The choice is whether we look at the bleak side, which is always there, or we look at what else is there. You and I, of course, it's a wonderful opportunity to for us to express this notion of the order that we espouse. But today, you know, we can see if you that when I was writing up the prologue for this today, you can see that I was talking about self-absorption. One path is self-absorption. Another option is followed by a sliver of mankind as a departure. The Masonic opportunity of fraternity, I suggest to you, is a tapestry incomplete. Whether you find yourself in our secular movement environment or a more strident religious theocratic atmosphere, the presence of the Masonic estate there is such a continuum of meaning and diversification produced by assumptions and drift. And we'll get into a little bit of that. We're going to enjoy a little bit of Walter Leslie Wilmshurst and General Albert Pike. And for a moment, set aside your preconceptions and join me today to look at the order broadly and personally. Use of the internet has generated new words that have sifted into everyday conversation. I wonder if masonry grows organically or what technology now calls virally or what observers call a social phenomena. Or is that a distorted picture of a philosophy with a cadre of men wondering if their sense of order is superficial or not? Are we trying to convince ourselves of something that's there or not there? Oh, get over your hissy fit. You're not 6 years old. This is serious. Are we trying to soothe ourselves with a balm of superficial philosophy? Or are we poor students or are we students in progress? Our studies incomplete? I want to encourage you to think that our studies are incomplete. We do have some people hanging around the Masonic bathroom, smoking and not really taking advantage of the opportunity. But we also have, I think, a growing number of people in the top floor of the library, in the corners of the laboratories, and with it cracking into the books and enjoying it, and enjoying the company of other people that they discover, like you, who are trying to make sense. And it's a big, big, big task. We can always do more. We can always do more with our mentoring. But our mentors have to be contemporary. They have to be well-informed, of course. They don't have to be. It's something that's part of our nature. We want that to happen. We do. We need to see that happen. We need to see the growth. So, regardless of the structure, regardless of leadership, the core beliefs of Freemasonry are deeply rooted in the fabric of meaning. I hope that I can convince you of that, but it would be, I think, wrong-minded not to challenge the notion of superficiality. It's there. It's there. Are we simply kidding ourselves? You know, patting each other on the back and trying to convince ourselves of something that is a fabrication. I tend to think there's evidence to suggest that this is something natural. The core beliefs of Freemasonry are deeply rooted in the fabric of meaning, I suggest to you. the thought of oracles, you know, the nature of mankind. I think, and not everybody may agree with that. You and I are the way and the means of defining those beliefs, because we are the peripatetic. We are given the task of demonstrating these beliefs. It's not enough just to sit and think deep thoughts. It's translating those thoughts into an application that develops and encourages common purpose. Not what we think, but what is. What is common purpose and what's best for everybody? Well, not everybody feels like they're part. Not everybody feels they belong. We live in environments where we know it's not better or worse than 1,000 years ago. We just know more about it. So the sense, if anybody's out there with the sense that, oh my goodness, things are, the doors have fallen off the Buick, okay. Go and take a look at some of the history, social history. Oh, that part of the sciences that we can't really figure out, ethics and morality. Oh my goodness, our early brethren had a firmer grasp. But then again, of course, there was a time when religion and science were single-minded. Look what we've done with that. Eh? So we have to come to these ideas in our own way, and test them in our own way, in our own time. Do you know France has the world's biggest tourist industry when measured in the number of travelers visiting the country each year? Right after that, going to the States and going to China seems to be enormously, enormously popular. Anyway, let's if you're enjoying this beautiful sunny day as much as the rest of us here in Ontario and most of Canada, let's hunker down to a little bit of work. We've got just a little bit to do. Not too much. This is we're coming up to, what's this, the fifth? This is World Hygiene Day. So, oh my goodness, there I am. I'm going to wash my hands right now. This is Liberation Day in the Netherlands, this is International Midwives Day somewhere in the world. The Feast of Saint George in Palestine, and Europe Day in all across Europe. World Laughter Day. There you go. Tomorrow you're coming up to Martyrs' Day in Lebanon and Syria. What irony there. World Asthma Day. Good grief. And it's World Furry Dance Day in Helston, Cornwall. Google the pants off. It's Truman Day in the States on the 8th. And Veterans Day in Norway on the 8th of May. White Lotus Day around the world on the 8th. World Red Cross and Red Crescent Day. Sadly, we couldn't do without those organizations, could we? And on the 9th, before I see you again, it'll be Liberation Day in Jersey. And then on the 10th, Military Spouse Day in the United States. And the 11th, something we can all appreciate, the Creator gives us, International Migratory Bird Day. And then the 12th is International Nurses Day around the world. And well, I'll see you again before then, won't I? I'll see you on the 12th. And we'll all get ready for National Apple Pie Day in the States. We won't get into that. Anyway, let's tie ourselves into some things Masonic that are going on. We have the renewal and regrowth and redevelopment, the regardening of our Masonic order coming up in July. And this is truly an interesting organization that is, rather than in taking many more expedient routes to this process of regrowth and renewal, this is where the ballot holds the day. And it's remarkable of course, it creates challenges in doing that. But it's challenges that are based on healthy engagement. It's something that I think we can be honestly proud to say is a part of our order. We, of course, have to embrace the idea that there's going to be, for some, this feeling of incompleteness. It didn't work out the way I wanted. I'm, of course, the center of the universe, but each one of us say that. But we should all be very pleased by the fact that we do this collectively, that we can be satisfied with the idea that we do not shy away from a process that we believe in because it's difficult. We have a constant stream of new minds coming in with new attitudes, new histories, and new ways of thinking. We have multi-generational thinking. And yet we stand to the challenge every year. Bring your ballot. Come in, earn your eligibility and then move forward. Everything is in that way preparation, isn't it? Everything. As Stan Laurel would say, another nice mess you've gotten me into. He did that in his film in 1930. Anyway, I've been the fascination that's been happening is these. I hope you've been taking to task some of the ideas that we're hearing about Walter Leslie Wilmshurst. This is just a remarkably interesting character. As I'm going through this material, it is a bit chewy, as I've said before, but be patient with it. Be patient. We'll only do this in little small windows, and then we'll move on. And I think because it's to do this in a group, I think it can be very off-putting. And because not everybody gets a chance to stand up and talk and give their views of it. So if you've been a regular listener of Home Companion, see if you can find a friend. See if you can find a mentor, somebody to sit down with you, a mensch, a buddy, a brother, try and convince them that there's some merit in understanding this stuff. And we're not sure quite what the merit is, but you know, this material has been around for a while, so it stood the test of time. It will help put some of the contemporary ideas into context. And I'm not a fan of status quo. Well, even if I was, time doesn't seem to ever stop change. And for us to do that in any way is anathematic to our order. So whenever we hear that, we're just seeing, there's some people that are more short-sighted than others. Doesn't really stop the fact that change does happen. I'm always, when I think about this kind of an idea, I always remember the Pony Express. And, you know, when I was a little boy growing up, it was always seemed to always be in the background of cowboy movies, Roy Rogers or Gene Autry or the Cisco Kid. And yet the Pony Express was only around 2 or 3 years. And the ads ran, you know, you had to be like 18, 19 years old, a good rider, able to handle a gun and not be too afraid of dying. So, and it did. It was replaced by steam. Huh? A great idea. Tear across the countryside on a horse and change your horse as soon as they became exhausted. But very Western American romanticism at its best. But sit back on a train, grab a cup of coffee or have a glass of whiskey and you get to get there better, faster, safer, until the bandits found you. Let's talk about the deeper meaning of symbolism of Freemasonry. And just remind yourself that this is moving forward with the idea that the emerging ideas inside your mind are the essence of Freemasonry. The lodge, the temple, is within the mind. Lots to do. The symbolism of our work becomes extremely profound and interesting. He who desires to rise to the heights of his own being must first crush and crucify his own lower nature and inclinations. I think that means a little bit of that self-centeredness. Oh my goodness, if I'm actually listening to ideas that don't agree with mine, well, there's the first challenge for you as a Mason. That's the whole idea. That's what you agree to. That's what we offer. And that's what the deal is. You're needing to know what the difference is between the potential of Freemasonry and the contemporary environment. How many fellows get that? This is about opening your mind and keeping it open, not closing it like a steel trap because you just don't know any better. This is your opportunity to know better. So we crush it. Wally's a little bit over the top. Crush and crucify our own lower nature and inclinations. Put it to rest. Then move on. That means opening your mind. And hopefully we'll be able to emerge with that sense of intelligence, of being able to have two competing ideas in our mind at the same time, two or more in our mind at the same time. That's what allows a good man to be able to understand another. He must perforce tread what elsewhere is described as the way of the cross. And that cross is indicated by the conjunction of those working tools, which when united form a cross. And that way is involved in the scrupulous performance of all we know whose working tools signify. Those working tools signify. So they substitute your own version of cross. That's sort of a doctrine that I don't necessarily subscribe to that doctrine. I think we're bigger than that. We're bigger. The cross is, there's lots of symbols, which refer to that. So whatever your understanding or your background, you know what I mean. And this I want, and I hope, is drawing us towards some greater sense of inclusiveness with a greater sense of qualifiers. And that way is involved in the scrupulous performance of all that we know this working tool signified by perfecting his conduct, by struggles against his own natural propensities. The candidate is working the rough ashlar of his own nature into the perfect cube. And I would ask you to observe also that the cube itself contains a secret. For unfolded, it itself denotes and takes the form of the cross. Wally, come on now. You just pull anything together, that's a little bit loose there. But nevertheless, he said it first. You know, you take a little, do this exercise. We've all probably done it. Do it out of, make a cube out of cardboard or paper and then unfold it and it forms the cross. The inward development, which the second degree symbolizes, is typified by the lowering of the triangular flap of the apron upon the rectangular portion below. Remember, they started off with that little peak up. This is the equivalent to the rite of confirmation. It denotes the process we have made in the science. Or, in other words, it indicates that the higher nature of the man, symbolized by the Trinity of Spirit, has descended into and is now permeated and now permeated his lower nature. The lower nature is really talking about passions and vices. And this isn't like, a matter of erasing those components. I don't know if anybody can do that. You know, the limbic system is pretty, the limbic part of our brain is pretty, is primitive. And that isn't necessarily unsophisticated. But there are, think of it in terms of basics. Primary functions that need to be carried forward. Hitherto, in a state of ignorance and moral blindness, the spiritual part of his nature has, as it were, but hovered above him. He has been unconscious of its presence in his constitution. But now, having realized its existence, the dayspring from on high has visited him, and the nobler part of him descends into his lower nature, illuminating and enriching it. We seem to be doing an overkill on this point over and over. the author is saying the same thing, that we have to be able to control ourselves, and unless we do, that's considered a weakness. It's considered an inability to control our basic needs, our basic self. But he taught us to persist with fortitude and with prudence, to develop the highest within with fervency and zeal. There's a lot of we're throwing around a lot of cliches here, but I think he's trying to draw on the language that we have in common, and bringing out the idea that we have to keep at it. This isn't something that's going to necessarily happen the first time we give a bit of thought to it. That's a process that means we come at this at different times in different ways. And it's that composite effort that helps us to, we'll say, take a step. And they're embellishing this, of course, with this notion of something that is almost undefinable. As some faith would put it, if you can define, if you start to define the creation, then you've defiled it somehow. And yet we struggle in our minds to have this notion that it's something greater than what our thoughts can define. Metaphysics, huh? He sees that difficulty, adversity, and persecution serve a beneficent purpose. This is referring more to the history of the major faiths that really pushed women aside. And we have so many references to gender that it wasn't always that way. It wasn't. It is now, as a lot of us grew up and thinking, this is the only thing I know. I only know red jello. So you're a heretic if you come along with lemon jello. I only know cherry. So take your lemon jello and get out of my country. Anyway, and so as the sign peculiar to the degree suggests, he endeavors to examine and lay bare his heart to cast away all impurity from it. And he stands like Joshua, praying that the light of day may be extended to him until he has accomplished the overthrow. And of his inward enemies, in case there's people out there that haven't been through it, we're talking about inward processes, dissensions inside, that grumpiness, that incompleteness, that, if you have the tendency to see the flaws in other people, this is the guy that is constantly correcting. It's not that he's proving himself right. He's really sort of suggesting or telling the world that he's uncomfortable with anything outside his own worldview, anything that isn't consistent with his thoughts is a source of anxiety for him. My. So we hear them as these, we call them know-it-alls. These are people that they don't know it all. If you think about it, we don't have agreement. Well, that's natural and normal. It's instinctive. We're not all on the same page because you see the world through different eyes. We have our own way of understanding ideas. We come at those accomplishments in our own way. That's the contemplative nature of Freemasonry. But for anybody to prescribe that the symbols of Freemasonry mean thus and such, I think is a little bit rough. Like me, when I talk about the symbolism of the lodge, I think it's a hugely interesting metaphor to explore when I think that the lodge room embodies the inner workings of the mind. And we look at things both factually, evidence, we can touch things, and then we can look at things metaphysically, and we can look at things through the lens of science. So when we look around, we're looking at things that are impermeable. Although when I touch the keyboard or my desk, it seems hard to the touch. But in fact, we know that it's made up of molecules, and we know it's made up of atoms. And molecules, in between those atoms is more space than matter. So then the neurology and science would physics would teach me that the what I see and what I know around me is impressionistic. It's impressions of things. So I have this impression of color, and I have this impression of permanence, and I have this impression of time, and impression of solids and gases, and in that way, we can begin to think that we're in this very fluid state of molecules and atoms, and there it's in constant motion, constant. Everything is around us moving. This just will give us all brain cramps in a second, so I'll get back to Wilmshurst. But the idea is, how do we develop conscious thought on all of this? How, in all of that motion and all of that activity, have we been able to develop self-awareness? And not only that, to be able to enjoy the company of people like you that are striving to develop that sense of consciousness. One day we'll sit down and talk about Carl Jung and reality. That I promise you we have to do that. How in the world can a thinking person take on these kind of tasks and considering that we don't want to walk around feeling glib about everything, but to truly understand without understanding what reality is. So, oh my goodness, we're going to drift into a little more science than we would normally normally want or normally have. So I don't think we need to have it spoon-fed to us, but like this, we have to go in small bits and bites. So before the attainment is reached, there remains for him, the attainment being the final grade. The aspirant who attains proficiency in the work of self-perfecting, to which the fellowgraph grade alludes, has passed away from the north side of the lodge, the side of darkness and imperfection, and now stands on the southeast side. So think about the lessons that are given from the northeast angle, the north side, where you're in symbolic darkness and you're receiving enlightenment. Perfect sense. And now stands on the southeast side of the meridian sunline of moral illumination, so far as the natural man may possess it. And this was a time when they were a bit harsh about it. These guys didn't, I think, have any sense that that there would be a day when we're looking at this memory and experience being somehow conveyed at a genetic level, genetic mirroring. How in the world did that come about? Well, these are boys that weren't really conceiving of that. Today, you and I can flip open a book and find that there's lots of ways that we can creep up on this issue. The only way of finding the limits of the possible is by going beyond them into the impossible. Arthur Clarke said that. So, you know, great mind, whether you like his work or not. Fascinating for some of us. In the places where the great mysteries have always been taught, what is ceremonially performed in our third degree is no mere symbolical representation as with us, but an actual vital experience of a most severe character. Severe. No, you're not being chastised here. One, the nature of which can hardly be intelligible and even credible. So I refrain, therefore, from more than one mere mention of this, observing only that it is one not involving physical death, and in this respect, only is our ceremony in accord with the experience symbolized. So, for if you follow closely the raising ceremony, although distinct reference to the death of the body is made, yet such death is obviously intended to be merely symbolical of another kind of death. Since the candidate is eventually restored to his former worldly circumstances and material comforts, and his earthly Masonic career is not represented as closely to coming to a close at this stage. All that has happened in the third degree is that he has symbolically passed through a great and striking change. Well, let's let's park it for a little while and get into some of Albert Pike. Before we do that, I just want to share a little bit with you here. I hope you like this. This is by a singer by the name of Carla Bruni. She is the wife of the former president of France, Sarkozy. And she was a singer before.
Quand ma main, when life goes wrong, try for a little French song. French song armé, puis démodé, me si douce fredonnée. French song tender, à l'envie, nostalgique à la.
Charming. Like that, sort of a spring song. Fits with the time of year, and we can have a little more of her music a bit later. But I think it sets the mood when you're getting into Albert Pike. A real man, a real boy, one of us, a real person. Not a version, not derivative. The authentic, as I would say. The only statue of Southern general in Washington is of Albert Pike. How do you go figure, eh? Yeah, he was an iconoclast. He did not think like the average person. I like to think that, you know, if we were all this level of scholar, he's a challenging and it's daunting to read his material and to begin to absorb and digest the depth of learning and the depth of the ideas. He adds four dimensions to the ideas that he talks about. And then you can see the underneath it all, or within and between those ideas, you can see the personality. You can see the man reflecting the times. And he's a different kind of a person. Today, if he was writing today, I suspect he would not be stuck in the past trying to pretend that he was 19th century or 18th century or 17th century. And certainly he would not be trying to talk about people and relationships and terms long gone past. You know, that parochial kind of nonsense. Doesn't seem to be dripping with sentimentalism. This is the author of the degrees that became the Scottish Rite, the rewriter, the person that put context and deeper meaning and philosophy in a format that could be followed by the likes of me. Political science. Why would you think that he would be shying away from talks about political science? As Ralph Waldo Emerson said, we are all inventors, each sailing out on a voyage of discovery, guided each by a private chart of which there is no duplicate. The world is all gates, all opportunities. So, let's see if we can use ours or if we can share. I want to look over the shoulder a bit and see if we can roll up our sleeves and do a little work and avoid the three evils that Voltaire talked about. He said the world spares us from three: boredom, vice, and need. And so I'm really saving you from boredom and vice and rage. We'll go on. Nevertheless, and I say this because you were all here last week. I presume you listened to the show. There are quite a few of you did from the stats that we're getting in here. We talked about political science being much improved as a subject of speculation, but it should never be divorced from the actual national necessity. So the science, conjecture, extrapolation, is never to override the sense of what's truly needed, what the people need at the time. So we see some of that loss. We see some theoretical applications. What the people need is set aside because we have people really truly trying to calculate drifts and change in current. The most obvious in the past 5 years has been what's happened with the pundits of economic theory. That became an unmitigated train wreck. And of course, these are proponents that studied the math and paid very little attention to the morality and the ethics. Oh my, yes, it's been said. And the only way I can say that is that whatever the training was, it wasn't enough because there were so many unethical practices. Right now, we're discovering $21 trillion in hidden accounts. $21 trillion. The people on the top have been squirreling it away to avoid paying their fair share. You and I pay a fair share. We don't have a problem with that. So it's this dishonesty that we're starting to ferret out. Oh, be assured that we have the tools to find it all. Eventually, if it is said there's a transaction, it will be known. That is the case. So now governments are saying, you know, we could raise the taxes, but what about this fair share business? What about this $21 trillion that's sort of squirreled away? Let's go after that stuff. So, yeah, there's Russians and Canadians and Americans and Brits. There's all people. Nobody's immune to this. This was considered being a cleverly, cleverly evasive about taxes. How did they get off on that? Something about fair play, wasn't it? Nevertheless, whatever follies that free people may commit, even to the putting of the powers of legislation in the hands of little competent and less honest, despair not of the final result. The terrible teacher experience, writing his lessons on hearts desolated with calamity and wrung by agony, will make them wiser in time. Pretense and grimace and sordid beggary for votes will someday cease to avail. Have faith and struggle on against all evil influences and discouragements. have to keep the faith, baby. Faith is the savior and redeemer of nations. Faith is maintaining your principles even when there's a lot of people urging you to abandon them. This isn't about being rigid. This is about keeping your mind wide open. Wide open. When Christianity had grown weak, profitless, and powerless, the Arab restorer and iconoclast came like a cleansing hurricane. When the Battle of Damascus was about to be fought, the Christian bishop at the early dawn, in his robes, at the head of his clergy, with the cross once so triumphant raised in the air, came down to the gates of the city and laid open before the army the Testament of Christ. The Christian general, Thomas, laid his hand on the book and said, O God, if our faith be true, aid us, and deliver us not into the hands of its enemies. But Khalid, the sword of God, who had marched from victory to victory, exclaimed to his weary soldiers, Let no man sleep. There will be rest enough in the bowers of paradise. Sweet will be the repose, never more to be followed by labor. The faith of the Arab had become stronger than that of the Christian, and he conquered. Funny that we look at one besting the other. Funny. Not funny in a good way. And to mock another man's belief, for whatever our personal experiences, that's just short-sighted. Everybody's at risk all the time. We're at more risk if we see each other as dangerous because we don't know. Damn, every single time it's ignorance that kills us, isn't it? That thus, in that vision or apocalypse of the sublime exile of Patmos, a protest in the name of the ideal overwhelming the real world, a tremendous satire uttered in the name of religion and liberty, and with its fiery reverberation smiting the thrones of the Caesars, a sharp two-edged sword comes out of the mouth of the semblance of the Son of Man, encircled by the seven golden candlesticks, and holding in his right hand seven stars. The Lord, says Isaiah, hath made my mouth like a sharp sword. I have slain them, says Hosea, by the words of my mouth. The word of God, says the writer of the apostolic letter to the Hebrews, is quick and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the dividing asunder of soul and spirit. The sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God, says Paul, writing to the Christians at Ephesus, I will fight against them with the sword of my mouth, and it is said in the Apocalypse to the angel of the church at Pergamos. The sword is really the language, and the language is the tool of expressing ideas. So can we be stupid? Tends to be pour out of our mouth like honey. But it takes the bigger man to see the bigger man. It takes the bigger man to recognize and draw. And when you and I are around the bigger man, we don't like the feeling of being small. Small-minded, ingenuous, disingenuous, insincere, inauthentic. All it takes is one big man of principle to bring that out, to be able to stand firm when he's being mocked. And know that eventually, even though it does sting and reverberate right down to the soles of his feet, and he could lose control of his passions, we're taught to control that. Get a grip. If the creator, the great geometrician, is sitting here, he's whispering to us today, this is English, we're here, we're not speaking in another language right now. He's whispering, get a grip, get a control over yourself. Pay attention. The spoken discourse may roll on strongly as the great tidal wave, but like the wave, it dies at last feebly on the sands. This man is sat by the ocean, isn't he? By the lake, by the water's edge. It is heard by few, remembered by still fewer, and fades away like an echo in the mountains, leaving no token of power. It is nothing to the living and coming generations of men. It was the written human speech that gave power and permanence to human thought. It is this that makes the whole human history but one individual life. Now you're getting somewhere. To write on the rock is to write on a solid parchment, but it requires a pilgrimage to see it. There is but one copy, and time wears even at that. To write on skins or papyrus was to give, as it were, but one tardy edition, and the rich only could procure it. The Chinese stereotype not only the unchanging wisdom of old sages, but also the passing events. The process tended to suffocate thought and to hinder progress, for there is continual wandering in the wisest minds. And truth writes her last words not on clean tablets, but on the scrawl that error has made and often mended. Trial and error, repeated effort, high principles, thoughtful of how we are coming across to the other man. Printing made the movable words prolific. Thenceforth, the orator spoke almost visibly to listening nations, and the author wrote, like the Pope, his ecumenic decrees, urbe et orbe, and ordered them to be posted up in all the marketplaces, remaining, if he chose, impervious to human sight. Talking about writers, huh? The doom of tyrannies was thenceforth sealed. Satire and invective became potent as armies. The unseen hands of the geniuses could launch the thunderbolts and make the ministers tremble. One whisper from this giant fills the earth as easily as Demosthenes filled the agora. I'll go and Google that, of course. D-E-M-O-S-T-H-E-N-E-S. Demosthenes. Go and check that one. Incredible. It will soon be heard at the Antipodes as easily as in the next street. God, I've got to get his dictionary. It travels with the lightning under the oceans. It makes the mass one man, speaks to it in the same common language, and elicits a sure and single response. Speech passes into thought and thence promptly into act. Speech isn't thought. Speech is a sort of a very rough way of trying to find something that is very pure, very clean. Think of it like mathematics, and you know how math is, although it does change, the mathematicians tell us, or physics, you know, there's a sharpness to physics. Physics or mathematics without ethics is an abomination. But there's a clean, there's a clarity to it. It's like the clarity of the flame. These are things that we're taught, we're introduced as we sit by the altar. We have to wonder why this form, why this item? Well, these are the sound of a bell, the voice of the Creator. Why besmirch? You know, if we're in, if we're created in the Creator's image, then it's wrong to portray the human form, because it equates to the human image. Only if that's what you think. Only if the human image that we're talking about is metaphysical. We could draw pictures of people and photograph people, but it doesn't even come close to approximating what we're really talking about here. The Hindus might have a better sense of it, you know, that ability to have different expressions and different connections, and the finding the Creator and redefining it endlessly. It will soon be heard at the Antipodes as easily as in the next street. It travels with the lightning under the oceans. This is speech, the ideas. Speech passes into thought and thence promptly into act.
A nation becomes truly one with one large heart and a single throbbing pulse. Men are visibly present to each other, as if already spiritual beings, and the thinker who sits in an alpine solitude, unknown to or forgotten by all the world, among the silent herds and hills, may flash his words to all the cities and over all the seas. Writing and books really did allow us that. Select the thinkers to be legislators and avoid the gabblers. Wisdom is rarely loquacious. I just love that word. Weight and depth of thought are unfavorable to volubility. So here we see the first evidence that this fellow understands that we want to take this meal and digest it very, very gradually. It's too much, you know. It's too rich to just be living a steady diet of it. And it's too unrealistic to think that somebody could and grasp all the nuances. Was that grape in that Pinot Noir grown on the north side of the mountain, or was it grown on the southeast angle of the mountain? And what did it get exactly? 65 degrees. Did it get exactly 17 degrees weather on the 9th of May? My goodness. We have to... Oh, my goodness. We're so guilty of that kind of tripe. The shallow and superficial are generally voluble and often pass for eloquent. More words, less thought is the general rule. He always has a point here, boys. The man who endeavors to say something worth remembering in every sentence becomes fastidious and condenses like Tacitus. That's a read about Tacitus. T-A-C-I-T-U-S. Again, gives us a texture. Reading. The vulgar love of more diffuse stream. The ornamentation that does not cover strength is the gigas of Babel. Neither is dialectic subtlety valuable to public men. The Christian faith has it, had it formerly more than now, a subtlety that might have entangled Plato, and which has rivaled in a fruitless fashion the mystic lore of Jewish rabbis and Indian sages. It is not that this converts the heathen. It is a vain task to balance the great thoughts of the earth like hollow straws on the fingertips of disputation. It is not this kind of warfare that makes the cross triumphant in the hearts of the unbelievers, but the actual power that lives in the faith. So there is a political scholasticism that is merely useless. The dexterities of subtle logic rarely stir the hearts of the people or convince them. He's saying to us, the dexterities of subtle logic rarely seem to work. The true apostle of liberty, fraternity, and equality makes it a matter of life and death. So we need to be courageous. If we have this faith and we have it this deeply, then it's so. But we shouldn't necessarily expect everybody to be on board. He's not saying stupid is the difference. He's saying it rarely works. He's talking about the idea, not the vehicle. His combats are like those of Bossuet, combats to the death. The true apostolic fire is like the lightning. It flashes conviction into the soul. The true word is verily a two-edged word, a two-edged sword. Matters of government and political science can be fairly dealt with only by sound reason and the logic of common sense, not the common sense of the ignorant, but of the wise. The acutest thinkers rarely succeed in becoming leaders of men. A watchword or a catchword is more potent with the people than logic. He's talking about branding. He's talking about advertising, isn't he? A watchword, a buzzword, is more potent When a political prophet arises to stir the dreaming, stagnant nation and hold back its feet from the irretrievable descent, to heave the land as if with an earthquake and to shake the silly, shallow idols from their seats, his words will come straight from God's own mouth and be thundered into the conscience. He will reason, teach, warn, and rule the real sword of the Spirit. It is keener than the brightest blade at Damascus. Such men rule a land in the strength of justice, with wisdom and with power. Still, the men of dialectic subtlety often rule well because, in practice, they forget their finely spun theories and use the trenchant logic of common sense. But when the great heart and large intellect are left to the rust in private life, and small attorneys, brawlers in politics, and those who in the city would be only the clerks of notaries or practitioners of the disreputable courts are made national legislators, the country is in her dotage, even if the beard has not yet grown upon her chin. In a free country, human speech must needs be free, and the state must listen to the meanderings of folly and the screechings of its geese and the brayings of its asses, as well as the golden oracles of its wise and great men. So does our order have that capacity? Do we hear sort of the mundane, the screechings of the geese and the braying of its asses? Yeah, I guess we do. We're being told that we are, I don't think we're a country, but we're certainly a free order. And freedom of speech is something that we applaud, even if it irritates us. It's a price that we're more than willing to pay, because to do otherwise would be despotism. Even the despotic old kings allowed their wise fools to say what they liked. The true alchemist will extract the lessons of wisdom from the babblings of folly. That's you. Oh, did I mention that this was an alchemist laboratory? Oh, yeah. Even a fool will sometimes hit the mark. There is some truth in all men who are not compelled to suppress their souls and speak other men's thoughts. Let me go over that. There is some truth in all men who are not compelled to suppress their souls and speak other men's thoughts. It's a sign of emotional maturity when you start to come up with ideas on your own. The finger even of the idiot may point to the great highway. A people as well as the sages must learn to forget. Ah. Move on. Move on. Don't be caught up in the petty politics. Although it may be sting, move on and the sting will fade. Learn from it. To unlearn is to learn, and also it is sometimes needful to learn again the forgotten. As you go on, you'll begin to think, you've forgotten more things than you know. I used to know about that, but I've moved on. Yes, of course, you and I and all of us evolve constantly. That's what we heard earlier, is that constant movement of ideas. Our thoughts aren't static. They are constantly being challenged, constantly being reinforced. And when we find somebody that's a bit of a dollard and keeps in and saying this, that boring kind of person, we don't know whether it's because they're finding new evidence. It's really weird when you start to talk to folks and begin to realize that we may be doing the same thing that other people do. We may be finding evidence to support a half-baked idea. Lord knows it's easy enough to do that. How do you know whether the ideas that we have are valid or right or accurate or best or make sense at all? Well, we do that from what we're learning here. These are the tools to help us to evolve. It is neither If it neither learns the new nor forgets the old, it is fated, even if it has been royal for 30 generations. They include you and I in there. If we neither learn the new nor forget the old. Forget the old. And replace the old with something better. A new idea. That's what he's saying. Oh, remember, this is Albert Pike we're looking at. Rightfully so, he did edit and re-edit. So we may be reading the ideas of somebody else, but I would think that we all can agree that Al had nailed it. He was a person of formidable intellect and capability. And he left us with these things to ponder, as a good teacher would. The antics of fools make the current follies more palpable, as fashions are shown to be absurd by caricatures, which so lead to their exportation. The buffoon and the zany are useful in their places. The ingenious artificer and craftsman, like Solomon, searches the earth for his materials and transforms the misshapen matter into glorious workmanship. The world is conquered by the head even more than by the hands. Nor will any assembly talk forever. After a time, when it has listened long enough, it quietly puts the silly, the shallow, and the superficial to one side. It thinks and sets its work. The human thought, especially in popular assemblies, runs in the most singularly crooked channels, harder to trace and follow than the blind currents of the ocean. No notion is so absurd that it may not find a place there. The master workman must train these notions and vagaries with his two-handed hammer. They twist out of the way of the sword thrusts and are invulnerable overall, even in the heel against logic. The martel or mace, the battle axe, the great double-edged two-handed sword must deal with follies. The rapier is no better against them than a wand, unless it be the rapier of ridicule. What's he saying? Be precise when you mock your enemy? Curious, isn't it? War is not a demon without remorse or reward. It restores the brotherhood and letters of fire. When men are seated in their pleasant places, sunken in ease and indolence, with pretense and incapacity and littleness, usurping all the high places of state, war is the baptism of blood and fire, by which alone they can be renovated. It is the hurricane that brings the elemental equilibrium, the concord of power and wisdom. So long as these continue obstinately divorced, it will continue to chasten. We need power. We need the power and we to be blended with wisdom. In the mutual appeal of nations to God, there is the acknowledgement of his might. It lights the beacons of faith and freedom and heats the furnace through which the earnest and loyal pass to immortal glory. There is in war the doom of defeat, the quenchless sense of duty, the stirring sense of honor, the measureless solemn sacrifice of devotedness, and the incense of success. Even in the flame and smoke of battle, the mason discovers his brother and fulfills the sacred obligations of fraternity. Tu, or the dyad, is the symbol of antagonism, of good and evil, light and darkness. It is Cain and Abel, Eve and Lilith, Jachin and Boaz, Ormuzd and Ahriman, Osiris and Typhon. Three, or the triad, is most significantly expressed by the equilateral and the right-angled triangles. There are three principal colors or rays in the rainbow, which by intermixture make seven. The three are the blue, the yellow, and the red. The trinity of the deity, in one mode or another, has been an article in all creeds. He creates, preserves, and destroys. He is the generative power, the productive capacity and the result. I've never heard it put quite that way. I've usually heard it as something said with no thought behind it. Dabba, dabba, dabba. He is the generative power, the productive capacity, and the result. The immaterial man, according to the Kabbalah, is composed of vitality or life, the breath of soul, the breath of life or mind, and spirit. Salt, sulfur, and mercury are the great symbols of the alchemists. To them, man was body, soul, and spirit. Four is expressed by the square or four-sided right-angled figure. One of the symbolic Garden of Eden, out of the symbolic Garden of Eden flowed a river divided into four streams. Pison, which flows around the land of gold or light. Gihon, which flows around the land of Ethiopia or darkness. Hedekel, running eastward to Assyria. And the Euphrates. Zechariah saw four chariots coming out from between two mountains of bronze, in the first of which were red horses, in the second black, and in the third white, and in the fourth grizzled. And these were the four winds of the heavens that go forth from standing before the Lord of all the earth. Ezekiel saw the four living creatures, each with four faces and four wings, the faces of a man and a lion, an ox and eagle, and the four wheels going upon their four sides, the Saint John behind the four beasts, full of eyes before and behind, the lion, the young ox, the man, and the flying eagle. Four was the signature of the earth. And four, in particular, of living creatures. Therefore, in the 148th Psalm of those who must praise the Lord in the land, there are four times four and four in particular of living creatures. Visible nature is described as the four quarters of the world and the four corners of the earth. There are four, says the old Jewish saying, which take the first place in the world. Man among the creatures, the eagle among birds, the ox among cattle, and the lion among wild beasts. Daniel saw four great beasts come up from the sea. Five is the dyad added to the triad, dyad and triad. It is expressed by the five-pointed or blazing star. The mysterious Pentalpha or Pythagoras. It is indissolubly connected with the number seven. Christ fed his disciples and the multitude with five loaves and two fishes, and the fragments were there remained 12, that is, five and seven, baskets full. Again, he fed them with seven loaves and a few little fishes, and there remained seven baskets full. The five apparently small planets, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, with the two greater ones, the Sun and Moon, constituted the seven celestial spheres. So we go on 6 days, 7 days. Next time we get together, we'll take on seven. Okay? This is... Finally, we are starting to stray away from the, hard to believe we would talk about morality with a man of this period, not talking about having a religiously or theologically infused language. So it seems quite odd in our secular environment, you know. I think I'm trying to get through the trying to understand the Quran, and I say trying because I'm
I am, after all, a Gentile. There's much that I don't understand that I try to understand. So eventually, when I think that I can have a bit of a grasp of that to do some service, or to do us some service, I'd like to try and share this, see the greatness of that work as well. Of course, I'm trying to keep my mind as open, because I think there's tremendous possibilities. It is, after all, a source of great hope. Now, I couldn't leave you off without giving you a little bit of information to move and impress people in your work and in your everyday comings and goings. This is more material that I want you to work into work into your conversation over tea this morning. It's a little bit of philosophy from Plato and a platypus walk into a bar. This is utilitarianism. We all know that the 20th century pinko Vladimir Lenin said, "The end justifies the means." But ironically, it's not too far from the view of one of the GOP God Squad's favorite philosophers, John Stuart Mill. Mill and the utilitarians proposed a consequentialist ethic. That means the moral rightness of an act is determined solely by its consequences. Consequentialists. The moral rightness is determined solely by its consequences. The protagonist in the following story is clearly a utilitarian. Mrs. O'Callaghan instructed the artist painting her portrait to add to it a gold bracelet on each of her wrists, a strand of pearls around her neck, ruby earrings, and a diamond tiara. The artist pointed out that that would be tantamount to lying. Said Mrs. O'Callaghan, "Look, my husband's running around with a young blonde. After I die, I want her to go crazy looking for the jewelry." Bada bing, bada boom. This sort of justification could presumably be used to condone some pretty serious stuff. If the consequence were felt to be good enough. There's another version of it, another about a widow. Excuse me. Mrs. Bevort, a widow, was hanging out by the pool at her country club when she spotted a handsome man sunning himself. She sidled up to him and said, "Well, I don't believe I've seen you here before." "Not likely," the man said. "I've been in the penitentiary for 30 years. "Really? What for?" "I murdered my wife." "Ah," said Mrs. Bevort, "so you're single." So a guy says, "Would you sleep with me for $1 million? And she says, $1 million? Wow, I guess I would." He said, "How about for $2? "Get lost, buddy. What do you think I am?" We've already established that. Now we're just haggling over the price. Utilitarians. The influential contemporary utilitarian Peter Singer, often draws analogies between decisions that we all agree involve horrendous consequences and seemingly benign decisions that he contends are ethically similar. In one essay, he opposes a situation in which one can earn money by buying a new TV by selling a homeless child to a corporation that will harvest his organs for transplants. Way bad, we all agree. But then Singer argues that any time one buys a new TV in lieu of sending money to a charity, that protects homeless children. He is doing essentially the same thing. Don't you hate it when he says things like that? It's an argument by analogy from a dramatic particular to a general moral pronouncement. So work that notion of utilitarianism and consequentialisms into your everyday conversation, and I think you will all be better off listening to you. As 13th century Hindu philosophy says, do not to others what you do not wish to yourself. This is the whole Dharma. Heed it well.
And 13th century Judaism says, what is hateful to you, do not do to your neighbor. That is the entire Torah. The rest is commentary. Go learn it. And Zoroastrianism, the 12th century, human nature is good only when it does not do unto another whatever is not good for its own self. Needed to be said, huh? Needed to be said. I'll play you out with a little bit more about Carla Bruni, shall we? Or I think that might work. I hope you like it. I hope you like the show. I find that this is a bit of a brain cramp going through this, but I think it's really important to understand. Anyway, commit acts of random kindness and make them acts of random Masonic kindness. I know you will, and I look forward to meeting you all. I want to thank Moffett Lodge for their hospitality last week and congratulate the districts of Georgia North and South for a really incredible Grandmaster's Banquet. The work goes on, and it's such a pleasure to have the encouragement and inspiration of all of you. See you soon.
See you next week. Bye.